What'll it take to raise the federal debt ceiling?
And what's at stake for the economy?
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon in for Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, June 6th.
Coming up, we'll speak with a leading conservative economist about the debate over the debt ceiling.
As school gets out for summer, what are the employment prospects for the nation's teens?
And turning the tables on the big banks, it is sweet justice for one homeowner in Florida.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
Vice President Biden will meet with members of Congress again this week to try and reach a deal to raise the federal debt ceiling. The Treasury Department has said the nation will start defaulting on its obligations if there's no deal by August. But on ABC News yesterday, White House economic advisor Austin Goolsbee had this warning for lawmakers who want to push the debate right up to the limit.
This is not an alarm clock. It would be extremely dangerous to get right up to the edge. Or you've seen some people even saying, well, it'd be okay if we defaulted for a short period. That's not true. We shouldn't do that. We should resolve this.
Now, last week on this show, we spoke with Jared Bernstein, the former chief economist for Vice President Biden, about this issue. This morning, we're pleased to welcome conservative economist Douglas Holtz Aiken, who heads the American Action Forum. Welcome to Marketplace.
Happy to be here.
Well, you think that Congress will raise the debt ceiling in the end. What do you think is going to be necessary for them to do that?
I think that in order for it to happen, there will have to be associated with it some real cuts in spending, both in the near term and then some changes to the long-term entitlement programs, the big one being Medicare, which would demonstrate to financial markets that we're serious about the real core problem.
Do you have a ballpark figure in terms of how big those cuts might end up being?
The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has said that he would like to see more in cuts than the increase in the debt limit. And so that gives you a ballpark. If you want a bigger debt limit increase, you need more cuts.
We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars.
I think there's no question the U.S. problem is a trillion-dollar problem. So anyone who's playing with small billions is in the wrong ballpark.
Would conservatives like you accept tax increases as part of the deal?
There's no real intellectual case to be made for the tax increases. If you look around the globe at countries that have a simultaneous growth problem, and we have a very bad growth problem, and a budget problem, the recipe for success has been to keep taxes low and then cut spending on transfer programs and government employment. That really is a playbook that the U.S. should run and be much more successful.
Well, some people would disagree with that, but the argument that would be made is if the poor are going to have to suffer in terms of cuts to services they rely on, why shouldn't the rich also have to suffer a little bit in terms of paying some more taxes?
Raising taxes is not going to be good for growth, period. And so the question then is, can you have a balanced package of spending restrictions, which affects both the affluent and the poor? And the answer, of course, is yes.
If you look overseas, you see the United Kingdom, which enacted steep cuts to get their deficits under control, and their economy is now shrinking. Isn't that evidence that if we make big budget cuts, that's exactly what's going to happen here?
Well, I think if you look at what we're doing right now, we're perilously close to being in that position anyway. So what we really have to do is build a stronger foundation for jobs. And sailing directly into what the president's chairman of his fiscal commission said was the most predictable crisis in history. We will have a financial crisis if we don't change course. That has to be the right thing to do for the American economy.
Douglas Holtz Aiken, president of the American Action Forum, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And for more on this story, let's bring in our regular Monday guest, Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, and she joins us now from New York. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Julia, if there is a deal that comes along with steep spending cuts, as Douglas Holtz Aiken was just talking about, would that satisfy the markets, do you think?
Well, I think the ideal outcome from the market perspective, and also probably from the rating agency perspective, is something that does address the entitlements, as Mr. Holtz Aiken mentioned, and those longer-term structural issues that are just going to get worse and worse, and does so in a credible way, but at the same time doesn't cut too much or raise too many taxes in the near term, because the recovery is fragile. And if you do start shrinking or going back into recession, then that fiscal austerity simply becomes infeasible. So you want to ramp it up gradually, let the economy continue to get its feet under it, and then you can potentially grow your way to pay off these deficits. But you can't bring the hammer down too quickly in the near term.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks so much as always.
My pleasure.
The nation's top central banker, Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke, is set to speak in Atlanta this week, and it seems likely he'll touch on last week's sorry job numbers. They've made one group especially antsy, teenagers. Fewer and fewer are finding jobs. Tracy Samuelson reports.
Meet a frustrated job seeker.
My name is Benson Hu. I'm 16, and I'm from Queens, New York.
Benson is finishing his junior year of high school and would love to work at a museum this summer. He's also applied for jobs through a New York City program for teenagers. So far, no luck. Same as last summer and the summer before that.
It seems like every other, you know, job application is based on like a lottery or just a random pick, especially for like kids my age.
This summer is the worst labor market for teens since the government started tracking them at the end of World War II. Only a quarter of the 17 million kids aged 16 to 19 will find summer jobs. That's according to a recent report by the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University. A lot of the summer jobs once held by teens simply aren't available anymore.
What we've gradually done is moved young people away. We took it from the gas station, we took it away, grocery store. The average person grocery store is packing your groceries, somebody 55, 65 years old. So a lot of the basic jobs that we gave to young people, you know, we've kind of reoriented work and taken it away from them.
Andrew Sum co-authored the Northeastern study. He says tough times have drawn older workers into the market for permanent part-time positions. Employers would rather hire them than train new kids each summer. So teens simply aren't getting a start in the working world. Professor Sum says that has implications beyond August. Things like juvenile delinquency, teen pregnancy, high school attendance rates, and even future earning power.
The more you and I work throughout our teens, the more you and I are going to work when our early 20s. We'll not only work more, but we'll get better paid.
In Queens, Benson knows it's a tough labor market for everyone, not just him. But that doesn't make it any easier to face the same struggle year after year.
Well, I'd say up until now, I have a lot of patience. Just hope it doesn't run out.
Any job would be better, he says, than doing SAT test prep for the third summer in a row. In New York, I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This weekend, a deadly horse virus continues to force cancellation of horse shows across the country, including one event known as Cutting. And as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports, that's cutting into millions of dollars in earnings.
Sharon Tullis from Hermiston, Oregon, has been cutting for more than a decade.
Cutting is where you go into a herd of cattle, and the object is to pull a cow out, and you are judged on how well your horse works the cow.
It's big business. About $40 million in prize money is handed out every year. But since April, a highly contagious virus has killed 12 horses and caused a nationwide shutdown of cutting events. Brad Smith is the president of the Washington Cutting Horse Association.
There are a number of shows in different disciplines being canceled, so it's had a substantial impact.
No rodeos have been called off, but they're taking precautions, says cutter Sharon Tullis.
Canceling one of these rodeos would be like canceling, you know, an NFL football game. It's just not as easy as it is to cancel a horse show or a cutting.
Cutting events are scheduled to resume in mid-June if the virus is contained. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Now the Marketplace global perspective. A possible second bailout for Greece is still being hammered out in Europe since last year's big rescue package failed to pull the country out of its debt crisis. Now, a fresh report shows just how vulnerable U.S. banks might be to the ongoing crisis. Joining us now on this, Marketplace's Amy Scott. Good morning.
Morning, Bob.
Amy, how did U.S. banks get so tied up in European finances?
Well, it's the way the global economy works. You know, banks lend to other banks. They're all sort of tied up together. And according to the Bank for International Settlements, which is a group of central banks from around the world, U.S. banks have $41 billion in actual and potential exposure to Greece. That is in the form of loans and other financial transactions. And it makes the U.S. second only to France in that department. U.S. banks are also heavily exposed to other troubled economies like Portugal and Ireland.
So if Greece or any of these countries were to default on their debt, how worried should we be?
Well, I asked a banking consultant, Bert Ely, that question, and he says that banks have hedged against that risk, so it's not likely to drive any of them, you know, out of business. But he says the bigger concern is the impact on the global economy.
If these debt defaults lead to a substantial slowing of economic activity, then, you know, that just has a slowing effect on the global economy, and that feeds back into the U.S.
And that's at a time when we're learning our own economy isn't, of course, recovering as fast as many thought.
Uh-huh. Marketplaces. Amy Scott, thanks.
You're welcome.
The International Monetary Fund has agreed to loan Egypt $3 billion. Following the uprising there, the country faces huge deficits and at the same time, big demands for social spending, as the BBC's John Lyne reports from Cairo.
The $3 billion loan from the IMF is just one of a series of cash infusions. Saudi Arabia has already given $4 billion in grants and loans. The United States has pledged $2 billion. Qatar says it's going to invest $10 billion. But Robert Mabro, director of the Middle East Centre at St Antony's College, Oxford, is sceptical about whether the IMF deal will shore up the gaping hole in Egypt's finances.
The sums are too big, the benefactors are not that generous, and the political pressures are quite strong.
Vital tourist revenue is down, and for a time, much of the country's economy ground to a halt. At the same time, the new government has increased the minimum wage and pledged to spend more money on housing, health and education. In Cairo, I'm the BBC's John Lyne for Marketplace.
That whining coming from international airlines today isn't just from their jet engines. It's the sound of an industry complaining about sharply falling profits. From the Europe desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Airline profits soared last year as the global economy recovered from recession. They reached $18 billion. But this year, profits have stalled and will likely plummet by 80%. The industry's trade body blames three main factors. The Arab unrest, that cut air travel to the Middle East. Japan's earthquake had an even more devastating effect on the vitally important Japanese market. But the trade body's boss, Giovanni Bisignani, says the biggest blow has been the steep rise in the price of oil.
$1 increase per barrel means $1.6 billion. We've seen that the oil has already increased by nearly 30%, and that is a big, big problem for us.
And an even bigger problem could be looming. He says the airlines could wind up in the red this year if the worst fears of a slump in economic growth are realised. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Just south of the country of Mongolia sits the northern Chinese province of Inner Mongolia. It's become the scene of what authorities have called a warlike situation. Troops have descended on the region in response to days of protests over large-scale coal mining. As our China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports, the Chinese government is moving to overhaul the region's mining industry.
A few weeks ago, a group of sheep herders in this remote region stood in the way of a coal truck. They wouldn't allow the driver to go any further, but the driver did. He ran over one of them, dragging him the length of a football field, killing him. The herder was ethnic Mongolian. The driver was Han Chinese, the country's ethnic majority. In the past, ethnic conflicts here have usually had one outcome, a brutal crackdown by government police. But this is more than an ethnic conflict. Mongolian activist Ekbat Togochog says it's an economic one.
Inner Mongolia has become the energy base of China and then becoming the largest coal producer in China.
And that's why China's government is handling these protests delicately. The government has suspended mining in parts of the province and it's ordered mining companies to make sure they stay off local herding grounds. A slowdown of coal mining in this region threatens to raise energy prices at a time when the price of doing business in China is increasing like never before. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Got one for you, Jeremy, from the Marketplace Karma desk. A retired Florida couple spent the weekend celebrating what their lawyer called sweet justice. When Bank of America foreclosed on their house, they insisted they'd paid cash for the place, and they never took out a mortgage. Well, they took the bank to court, and they won. But no, that wasn't the sweet justice part, okay?
Okay.
The court ordered Bank of America to pay their legal fees, and when after 5 months, B of A still hadn't coughed up the money, the lawyer at the end of last week got sheriff's deputies to accompany him to the local branch in Naples, Florida, and he foreclosed.
Wow.
He threatened to load up a moving truck with furniture, computers, and any cash in the drawers. And after an hour of nervously negotiating, the B of A manager cut a check, paid up in full. almost $6,000.
Wow.
Now, a reader who posted a comment to the Naples News website seems to sum all this up. He said, every time I read this story, it brings a tear of happiness to my eye.
Probably a lot of people feeling like that when they hear that story.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Today, American TV networks are bidding for the broadcast rights to the 2014 and 2016 Olympic Games. NBC has carried the torch since 2000, but as Jennifer Collins reports, the Peacock's run may be over.
NBC reportedly lost more than $200 million on the Vancouver Olympics. Part of it could have to do with awkward programming.
The sport of curling, the sport which involves pushing that granite stone towards a bullseye, has been on CNBC for more than 30 hours so far.
And that was one of the Business Channel's own reporters. Now Disney and News Corp are also vying for the games. Sports economist Rodney Paul says Disney, which owns ABC and ESPN, may have an edge.
Given how well-branded the different networks are within ESPN's family, there's a much greater chance that ESPN gets it than the previous time this bidding took place.
Porter Bibb of MediaTek Capital Partners says Disney has another advantage.
Only a Disney can make a profit by all of the ancillary revenue streams that the Olympics can create for them.
Think theme park rides, retail sales. Bid says the Olympic Committee needs to pick well. If the games lose money again, the next round's bids may not be as high. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
To Australia now, where McDonald's is saying sorry to its customers. Over the weekend, the company launched an ad campaign apologizing for the quality of its coffee. They weren't loving it. Stuart Cohen has the story from Sydney.
This cup's for you, complainers. Thanks to you, we've changed to a richer, smoother blend.
McDonald's is better known for its burgers than its quality coffee, but the company's chief operating officer in Australia wants to change that. She says Aussies have a sophisticated palate when it comes to coffee, and McDonald's wasn't pouring a quality brew. So the company has taken the unusual step of apologizing and promising a free cup of coffee to those who remain unhappy. For the few customers actually going into a McDonald's in downtown Sydney for the coffee, the reviews weren't exactly glowing.
Actually, it's not too bad. In comparison to other cafe places, I think it would meet the same standard, and it's a lot cheaper too.
The only problem is that sometimes you got to admit that it's cold. It's not always hot.
McDonald's launched its upscale McCafe coffee shop concept in Australia in 1993. It's now spread across the world, including to the United States. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
And finally, Bob, to Germany, where a Sweet 16 party got a little out of control over the weekend. The birthday girl put out an invitation on Facebook, and 15,000 people RSVP'd. Yes. Apparently, more than 1,500 showed up to the party, and more than 100 police officers came to disperse the crowds, which were getting pretty rowdy. In fact, the birthday girl fled the scene. She didn't want to be there, get in trouble for that one. A police spokesman said, quote, "Unfortunately, she forgot to mark the celebration as private."
Unfortunately.
Yeah, that's too bad. You got to remember to click that box in Los Angeles. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.